Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A new report looks at how many cases of COVID-19 might be linked to the Sturgis motorcycle rally. The Brookings City Council enacts a short-term mask mandate, plus the mayor of Sioux Falls solidifies the city's support of law enforcement. Today, we welcome Jonathan Ellis and Kevin Killer for our weekly State Politics Roundtable. Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Kevin Killer is a former state lawmaker and member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. Kevin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, welcome back as well.
Hey, thanks, Lori.
I want to start with this report from, it's a research group from San Diego, the Center for Health Economics and Policy Studies at San Diego State University. And they published this this report that talks about whether or not Sturgis was a super spreader event, evaluating cell phone data and people's behavior and who stayed home in the city of Sturgis, the population of Sturgis, all kinds of things coming together. And their assessment is that that you can tie 260,000 coronavirus cases in the month following the Sturgis motorcycle rally to Sturgis. Of course, the South Dakota Department of Health points out this isn't peer-reviewed, and they're using some assumptions that public health officials in the state are not comfortable with. We talked to Kim Elsom-Risden earlier in the program about this, but I want to talk about the politics of this a little bit. And Jonathan Ellis, let's start with you, because everybody has something to say about mask mandates in the state, about events like Sturgis in the state. It's become quite a national story, and we hear a lot from the governor's office about it. How political, how politicized is this story? Are we really trying to get at how many people got sick after Sturgis? Or are we trying to prove a point with science? What do you see as you look at the study and look at some of the ways it's being shared and used?
Well, yeah, this pandemic in this country and really around the world has turned into a political issue because, you know, if you're a governor or somebody who, a leader who locked down your state or your country with fairly severe lockdowns and, you know, you suffered some pretty devastating economic loss because of that, you don't want to have to go back and admit you were wrong. And likewise, for people in the, you know, the handful of states and countries that you know, kind of maintained more open, like South Dakota did, you don't want to say you were wrong, that maybe you should have locked down. So there it's definitely trench warfare on those two views, and there's a lot riding on that. I mean, if governors in Ohio, who Mike DeWine and some of the others who had these really swift lockdowns, and now they don't. Nobody wants to go back to the voters and say, yeah, we were wrong. Now, meanwhile, you've got various interest groups who've also lined up on both sides of that. And unfortunately, in my profession, at least especially on the cable news side of things, you see this study being used as a club against the governor here because they've maintained that the proper way to deal with this was to have severe pretty significant lockdowns on populations. And so obviously they've clubbed her with that, and she's maintained on her side that no, the best way to deal with this is to, is for people to have, make choices that are best suited for themselves. And so she's, both sides have a lot to gain and lose in this thing. And so that's why it's become so very political. With regard to the study itself, I mean, again, in journalism, you're supposed to have a healthy dose of skepticism for these types of events or studies, and I'm certainly skeptical about some of the claims made in this, and certainly we'll look forward to it being peer-reviewed in the coming future here, because I see nothing within what I've seen of the study. I mean, we don't have basic, from what I've read of it, we don't have some basic information, modeling information that they used to kind of, what the reproductive rate is that they were using, what susceptible rate. I mean, there's some basic things missing that I, from what I can tell in the study, and I've always kind of skimmed it, but I, the data that they're using is fairly unique in my mind from what I've seen in terms of trying to model outbreaks. And it's interesting data, I'll tell you that. I'm a data guy. I mean, it's certainly interesting data. But again, I'm going to look forward to other people kind of getting into the guts of this thing and I'm hesitant to believe it at face value.
So much of it, I thought, as I was reading through it, was really making making a case for how people behave in an event. And some of it was just common sense, like people went to work in Sturgis to be supportive. So I, in some ways, they were covering ground that if you live in Sturgis or if you live in South Dakota, it was pretty standard. And I thought some of the language was making it sound like that was, you know, they were incredulous about that as well. So there's a lot to unpack in that study. But Kevin Killer, I want to bring you into the conversation. The scientists are still working on, you know, what is a super spreader event? Why did we not see cases coming out of one event, but we do see cases coming out of another? And as that science is sort of, as those studies are being done, as we live through this pandemic, from a political standpoint, I think, do you agree with Jonathan that people on either side are sort of using whatever they can grasp as a club against the other side for political gain at this point, particularly in an election year?
I think that's correct, you know, in understanding that, you know, the environment that we're in is really hypercharged right now. And really figuring out, okay, how do we have a common discourse? Because I think at the end of the day, you know, again, I think it's always figuring out what can our systems handle this kind of event, and really understanding that, you know, being in a rural area such as Pine Ridge and, you know, our rural healthcare systems, can they handle this kind of event? And always going back to that, you know, and I think that's one thing to be commended of, you know, again, you have that the compare and contrast that Mr. Ellis was talking about, of where, you know, you're basically having this discussion of, you know, even within the state, you have tribes locking down, you know, and actually modeling that, you know, because we don't have the adequate medical facilities to kind of deal with this kind of event. And it's reality is beginning to understand that concept and not, you know, not really getting involved in the larger national politics. And I think that's kind of the problem here, is just understanding that how do we kind of distance ourselves from that national conversation and bring it home to South Dakota and really understand that we just have to have a common discourse on this, you know, understanding, but also, you know, what is this going to be? Because this is the first time that we've actually had to deal with these kind of rising cases, because for the most part, South Dakota has done a great job of managing COVID because of the rural nature and the distancing. But I think, you know, when this hit, it also hit other states around us. Looking at how do other states compare, and then also like looking at Washington, D.C., which had a similar amount of population, but they're densely populated. You know, when COVID first hit, they had a spike, and then now they're kind of, you know, their cases are down. And we're kind of the opposite. Was where South Dakota, we didn't have a lot of cases, but since Sturgis happened, we had a lot of, you know, our cases went up. So it's just really beginning to understand having those conversations. So.
And Kevin, to that point, you know, one of the things the governor has said from the beginning is to really watch those hospital capacity numbers. And as we have watched those, you know, from my seat in the city of Sioux Falls today, as I sit here looking pretty good, that situation is entirely different if you're living in a community where there is extreme limited access to hospital beds. I have about 4 minutes to go before I get to a hospital bed. Do you think, from a big picture standpoint, Kevin, that people are waking up to infrastructure problems with healthcare, whether it's reservation-based or rural, you know, in rural South Dakota? Is the awareness increasing at, you know, how your life might be different because you don't have access to healthcare and to, in this case, hospital beds or intensive care beds?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a really good way to put it, just because, you know, understanding that, yeah, it might take 4 minutes to get to a hospital in Sioux Falls, and you have amazing healthcare facilities in a healthcare system in Sioux Falls, because we had two different private hospitals, you know, multiple medical providers at a smaller level. And even in Rapid City is that, you know, we have regional, or, you know, what is Monument Health now, and their providers, but understanding that You know, if I'm in Pine Ridge, I get COVID, I have symptoms. You know, you have to not only wait for the test, but you also have to figure out, okay, well, what is the next steps? Do I get referred out? That's an hour drive. And, you know, so by the time you show symptoms, you know, it might be almost a week later before you, you know, get seen or and get diagnosed. So understanding that, you know, this is raising a lot of these issues of, you know, how can we improve rural healthcare, and more looking at it more as a regional place, because I know that one of the factors in this too is Iowa, one of our neighboring states, has also had an outbreak because of the college's reopening and all that kind of stuff. And understanding that, you know, we need to really figure this out as a state to state, and just picking up the phone, you know, hopefully people can do that, you know, even at the state legislative level, and just having those conversations. Okay, well, how do we do this as a regional economy? Because even with our agricultural nature of this area, you know, that all depends on our regional economics. And I think the same kind of system can be applied to, you know, regional healthcare systems. So just understanding how do we begin to open those doors, you know, in Iowa and Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska. So.
Yeah. As we talk about division and people going back and forth, I want to play a little bit of audio here in a moment from the Brookings City Council meeting last night that Jackie Hendry was able to bring us. And this is a City Council meeting where they're discussing a short term, I think it's a 60-day mask mandate in the state, and people coming out and talking on both sides of it. We're going to play two pieces here, and the first one is from a Brookings attorney, and he is speaking against the ordinance for masks, and his name is Jared Gass. Take a listen.
What I keep hearing is that they have this right to protection and that my personal safety is someone else's responsibility. That's such an entitled, divisive opinion, very frustrating to me. What I heard on the first letter that was written was enacting an ordinance to protect the community is this council's responsibility? It's not. It never has been. I said this at the last meeting. Take that burden off your shoulders. It's not your job to protect us. We can protect ourselves and we can protect our families. What you have here with this mask mandate is a proverbial line in the sand. There are many people here saying this is where we draw the line. I'm included in that mix. Asking the healthy for the appeasement of the frightened is no way to govern a city needing to shut this down right now. What's next?
And now here on the other side is Sam Smith. He's teaches at South Dakota State University, focusing on scientific literacy. And here's what he had to say at the Brookings City Council meeting.
I'm here in support of this motion. I teach at SDSU, although I'm here in a personal capacity. I focus on scientific literacy in my class, in one of my classes, and the danger of cherry picking studies just to support your view. Instead of looking at the entirety of the data, I'm here in support because almost unanimously, our health experts nationally, statewide, and locally support measures like this, notwithstanding our home internet research amateurs here. While I understand the appeal to personal responsibility, when you walk into a public space and pass a virus to a family's grandparent, aunt, uncle, who ends up dying, how are we to hold you responsible for that? Your choices affect others, and that's where personal responsibility ends and public health begins.
And if you're just tuning in, those are some voices from last night's Brookings City Council meeting, and we're talking here with Jonathan Allison and Kevin Keller on In the Moment as part of our weekly political roundtable. Jonathan, later on in the show, we're going to have a conversation about how democracy works. And the city council did vote to pass the mask mandate 5-2. Plenty of people came and spoke. I think there was 3 hours of testimony. This is on display a lot of really what democracy looks like. People coming and saying, this is what, you know, I think it should be, and this is what I think your responsibility is. And then there's a vote, and not everybody's happy with that. Talk a little bit about this whole idea of people being heard, not just at the ballot box, but at these meetings, that local politics really, really matters, even if you don't get what you want when the votes are cast.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's a great system in the sense that, you know, our elected leaders are basically required to listen to people before they make a decision. And you see that they make their decision and explain their decision. And now they can be held accountable, as you say, at the ballot box. You know, it's an interesting step forward for Brookings. You know, they've added about 200 cases since the beginning of September, although, you know, they're voting to do this when cases have slowed fairly dramatically. So it's almost like they missed the boat if they wanted to use a mass mandate to slow things. I mean, there are only 4 new cases, I think, reported today. But yeah, that is the nitty gritty of representative democracy right there. Those two clips that you played.
And Kevin Keller, to your point, there has to be some common ground is a really good thing if we sort of move forward together, but it's a particularly divisive time right now. What are your thoughts on, you know, you've been in the State House, you've seen disagreements, you've seen people, you know, argue about things. Are there ways to find that common ground when people are so starkly divided?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing is this, you know, having elected leaders understand that, you know, and I think they feel the pressure too of being, you know, this is a really unique time, and having them listen more to their constituents, and even at the local level, as Mr. Ellis was pointing out, you know, that's people's first entry usually into politics, you know, like, because South Dakota is the way it is, you know, peers in the middle of the state, it almost takes 3 hours to get there from where I'm at, you know, 2 hours from Sioux Falls, 2 hours from Rapid City. So it's not the easiest place to get to, but, you know, going to your local council meeting, tuning into your, you know, your city council meeting, you know, going to your county commissioners, you know, that's more accessible. And I think with people beginning to understand that process and understanding how, you know, healthcare decisions are made and are affected by political leaders, people are showing up, you know, whether you oppose it or against it. It's beginning to understand that, hey, this is the discourse that you need to have, and this is the platform that's available, outside of if you own a business, you know, if you have your own health issues, you know, people can raise those all kind of ways. And I think one of the good things about being in South Dakota is that, you know, we really embrace that to a certain degree, and we understand that, you know, local government matters, and there's a really embrace of that at the state level, that, you know, we listen to our local governments, you know, and they know best, and we want to leave up that decision. And I, you know, that's what I do appreciate. You know, there is certain legislators who understand that, you know, tribes have the right to make their own decisions, just like county governments, and really understanding that this is a unique time, and we gotta take the steps that we need to do to protect ourselves and also listen to our constituents, because people are going to, you know, vary all over the place, you know. And I think that's the thing of being in a legislature, is that there's, you know, 70 different opinions when I was in the House, 35 different opinions on the Senate side, altogether 105 different opinions, not including mine, and and just beginning to understand that this is what we're dealing with, you know. So getting people to figure out, okay, we gotta again have those common conversations and you know, figure out what's going to be best for the state. So
yeah, and lives are at stake. Yeah. So Jonathan, I want to talk about the Sioux Falls City Council, because the news from Sioux Falls is about a new law enforcement training center, a raise or not. I'm not sure if it's a raise or not. Help me figure that out. But a salary agreement between the police officers and the mayor. And the mayor talking about how, in spite of what's happening nationwide, he's proud to say that here in Sioux Falls, the officers are supported. Tell us a little bit about what's new in that arena.
Yeah, I mean, there was a vote last night by the city council, as you alluded to, a $50 million new bond to build this training center and also to house the 911 and do some other things. And then in addition to that, you know, you approve your collective bargaining agreements with the union representing both police and firefighters. And there had been some friction, I think, early on between, obviously, between the mayor and the police union, you know, over some of those agreements. But, I haven't looked into the guts of the agreements in terms of, those usually include pay raises. Following the vote last night, you had the mayor tweet out some things saying he's proud that that they made two strong statements on what public safety means in our community, the bond and then obviously the collective bargaining agreements. Then he said, you know, I'm proud to see how Sioux Falls continues to recognize the importance of investing in public safety now more than ever. And then he thanked those two firefighters and police officers. And I think, you know, what he's implying there, he didn't come out and say it, obviously, but he's implying that Sioux Falls is sort of taking a direction of being supportive of its law enforcement and its first responders, whereas you see in other places in the country debate about whether to shift funding from police services to other types of services to try to address crime and perhaps mental health and other issues. So, you know, the mayor here is proudly waving that flag of supporting police and firefighters here.
Yeah. And Kevin, to that point, we were just talking to a candidate from the Minnehaha County area, and she was mentioning, Rhonda Milstead was mentioning early in the program, how many rural ambulance workers, EMTs, firefighters are all volunteer across the state of South Dakota, and just how little support they're getting. So once again, there's one story in Sioux Falls about what a training center might look like, and meanwhile in the rest of the state, or certainly in more rural areas of the state, that's a very different story. Anything you want to add to, you know, the funding for ambulance, EMTs, volunteer fire department? You have any thoughts on that, Kevin, before we wrap up today?
Sure. Yeah, no, and I think that's a great point that Mr. Ellis was talking about, of how, you know, you have different ways of, you know, allocating funding, you know, and especially in your city. But I think one of the things that COVID is exposing too is the mental health needs. And, you know, sometimes, you know, it's, you know, a police officer or law enforcement isn't trained to deal with mental health issues when they show up to different situations, you know, when opposed to, you know, if you call 911, somebody's, you know, not acting appropriately or not acting right, you know, that person might assume something's wrong, you know, but it might be a whole mental health issue. And I think, that, again, COVID is really exposing a lot of the problems that we have with our healthcare systems, you know, and yeah. Granted, you know, as state leaders, we need to begin to figure this out or state leaders, I'm not a state leader anymore, but, you know, as state leaders need to begin to explore these conversations and say that how do we figure out what's going to happen at the city level, at the rural level, and understanding that, you know, these issues are just going to keep expounding as if we keep ignoring them. And it's important that, you know, we especially take care of the mental health needs of this younger population in South Dakota. Because if we don't address that, it's just going to get bigger, you know. And like on the reservations, we have a huge young population. I think almost half of the population on Pine Ridge is under the age of 25. So, you know, you could just imagine what COVID is doing to this younger population, of just disrupting their flow, and they're not going back to school. So it's just totally disrupting their lives, what they knew it was, and beginning to understand, like, how do we really tailor and understand the needs of this population, and how does it factor into the larger discussions around South Dakota. So,
yeah, we'll be talking about this for a long time to come. Kevin Killer and Jonathan Ellis have been joining us for today's Dakota Political Junkies Roundtable. Kevin Killer, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jonathan Ellis, you can find his work at argusleader.com. Jonathan, thank you.
Hey, thanks, Lori and Kevin.